30th, 2012. This is Martha Bloomfield. I'm interviewing Chris Dantzisak for the Hmong book. Chris, can you say who you are, and do you give me permission to interview you and use your information for this book?
My name is Chris Dantzisak, and I give you permission to use this information for your book.
Okay. Now, I understand, first of all, thank you.
You're welcome.
And it was kind of serendipitous that you were involved with the Hmong way back when. The information that I have, but I don't know for sure that it's accurate, is that in 1976, in October, refugees Tang Bang and two of his younger cousins arrived in Lansing, and Tong Fur and a few members of his family resettled in Grand Ledge. And that St. Michael's in Grand Ledge was helpful and instrumental in establishing the refugee services of the Catholic Social Services, and helped resettle, sponsor and resettle some of these people. One of the questions I have, because I thought you had said that they came in the wintertime, this particular family, so we want to make sure that these are the same people, and if they're not the same people, to interview you about the people that you know.
Right. Well, there's only one family, Tong Fur, that I worked with.
Ah.
And.
So it's not the other, it's not Tang Bang?
No, I don't.
Okay.
They may have been related, but they were probably sponsored by another organization. Tong Fur was the family, his family, he and his wife, May Lou, were, and their children were sponsored by St. Michael's Parish in Grand Ledge.
And they came?
They came, now, it was either the fall or early winter.
Oh, okay, that's just.
It was one of those issues where we may have had an early snowstorm that day, that night, I'm not sure. Well, I know it was snowing when we saw them, but I can't recall specifically what month it was. It was in the late fall or winter.
And what was your role, and how did you become involved in this resettlement process?
St. Michael Parish in Grand Ledge, through the auspices of Catholic Social Services, got involved in the resettlement of Southeast Asian refugees following the collapse of the American-supported governments in Vietnam and prior to that in Laos. And we're supporting these folks. The federal government were letting them in, but requiring, as I understand at the time, that the group be sponsored by an organization which was committed to providing as many resources as possible to helping them make the transition to life in America.
How did you and your wife, Mary, decide that this was something that you wanted to?
We had actually, this was the second family that we had worked with, not quite to the same extent, but St. Michael Parish had a Vietnamese family that was here prior. And we worked kind of on the periphery of that committee in helping them to get settled here. And so when this family was coming, my wife, Mary, and I, with another woman by the name of Betty Marsh, agreed to be the co-sponsors of the committee.
Of the committee or of the?
Of the committee that was working within the church to support the family. So we would be the ones that would coordinate everything from obtaining housing to assisting in the job search and in various ways helping them to adapt to and understand the American culture.
But what was it that caught your attention? you do a lot of good things in the world, and I mean that. But why did this particular project?
Well, I think partly it was because I was anti-war in that period.
Ah.
And part of the consequences of the Vietnam conflict was the fact that at the end of it, we had a lot of people that were displaced because they had trusted America, become allies of America, and were basically run out of their countries with the threat of their lives hanging over them. And I felt that we had a moral responsibility to resettle them and to do all we could to help them to adapt to our culture as a result of the actions and faith they put in our government.
Now, one of the things that I've been learning through this process is that even before what we talk about, the Vietnam War, there was a secret war going on in Laos that traditionally Americans were not aware of. The American government made it look as if it was an education process and there was schooling for these people, and they would show the schools to the visiting diplomats when in fact there was this war going on. Now, some of the Hmong people who I've interviewed also referred to that war as the Vietnam War. And I've talked to them about it, and I guess because Vietnam was the more major component eventually, or that the Laotian communists were affiliated with the Vietnamese. But when you talk about it, I'm trying to understand now, was a specific family that you mentioned, Thong Her and his wife, were they from Laos? And were they Hmong people?
Yes, they were from Laos, and they were Hmong people. They were the same people that were featured and referenced by
Marcia McDowell
and her husband,
Kurt
Duhers. Yes, they were from Laos specifically. I believe that he was a member of the Laotian military. I believe he was a lieutenant, if my memory serves me. And as a result of that, upon the collapse of their military and their government, was forced to leave for Thailand. I know that they arrived from a camp in Thailand.
Well, it also to affirm or confirm what you're saying, this is 1976.
That date, I'm not sure. You might want to check the documents with McDowell and Dewhurst, because they may have documented those dates at the time that they did their special exhibit. I cannot remember.
Well, this is directly from them, but I'm thinking.
I'm trying to remember.
Whether it was 75 or 76, it was the military people who. And their families, there were 2,500 of them who came out first.
For the most part, yes, because they were the ones that would have been most threatened by, as the communist governments took over.
So, you were involved in with the committee from the church, and then you and Mary were the ones to actually greet these people when they came?
We were there with a delegation. The other woman, Betty Marsh, and I think our pastor at the time was there.
Do you remember his name?
I cannot remember.
Okay. Is he still there or not?
No.
Okay. So you were at the airport?
Right.
What was that like for you? I mean, you were saying, which I think is really interesting, in terms of your reasons for becoming involved, and everybody who I've talked to about their sponsors or the sponsors themselves, very different kinds of reasons why they decided to take on that role. So what was it like? I mean, had you heard of Hmong people before?
I was aware of them, and I was certainly aware of the secret war in Laos, and but as far as the actual experience, it was a, as I recall it now, and this has obviously been many, many years ago.
That's fine.
But it was, they arrived in the evening, it was dark, it was snowing, kind of a mixture of snowing and rain, and they came off the plane, and I think at that time they had two or three little children, one of which was had been born in the camp in Thailand and was basically a swaddler, and probably under a year old, and Mei Lu was holding the baby, and they came off the plane, and if they came closer, I think we had a sign that said, Mei Lu, the Tonghe family or something, and they came over to us. So this is the days before security at airports, like we know it today, so things were, we could get a little closer to people. But they came off the airplane, and the baby was basically wrapped in rags. They had run out of, I think, the probably dish rag or something from the airplane, because they had run out of diapers. The flight was something like 27 hours between Thailand and Lansing. So it was, in that sense, it was a pretty memorable experience. And Tong could speak a little bit of English because he had dealt with the American military for a number of years, and so his English was more than passable. Mei Lu did not speak any English whatsoever. So, it was hard to directly communicate with her. But it certainly has been an experience that I have never forgotten.
Why?
It was just a moving experience. I mean, thinking about what these people had gone through just that day, but not only that day, throughout their lives, and the transition that they were now being forced to make into a completely foreign, alien society.
Now, did they come just their family, or were they with another family on the same plane?
They were just their family. Or if there was relatives or something in that family. We did not deal with them that evening, so I don't recall that there was anybody else other than just their family.
And where did you take them that evening?
I believe we still had a house that the first refugee family was using, and we took them there that evening. Tried to, kind of give them a little bit of an idea of what toilets were and that type of thing, because it was some things that they were not familiar with. Tong was, to some extent, because he had spent some time a little bit more familiar with what we would consider modern necessities. But shortly after that, we moved them into a different home, a smaller place.
And what was your role after that, or how did you, you always do more than less. From there?
The woman that I mentioned, Betty Marsh, was kind of, she was at the time, she was retired, not working. She wasn't actually retired, I think, she just didn't work. But she did a lot of things on a day-to-day basis that the rest of us were not able to do. But we really had to, you know, spend time with them on a regular basis, you know, two or three times a week over
oh,
at the house.
Your house or their house?
Their house. We had them in our house, but mostly at their house, because we were trying to help them to, you know, become acclimated to the society. We took them grocery shopping, shopping
what was that
in
like?
General.
You shared some stories.
Yeah, it was obviously another unique experience, because you can just imagine you come from a camp in Thailand where, you know, you don't even have the basic necessities for the most part. Then you come to America, you have this, you know, a relatively nice home, at least it's dry and warm, and, you know, and then you go from that environment into a modern automobile, and then you privately go to a grocery store that, you know, has just about everything that you could ever think you would ever want from the standpoint of groceries, and then like Meijer with all the clothing and everything else and the toys and the
is that where you went to a Meijer?
Yeah, that's where we went. And so you can just imagine what that kind of, you know, what these folks must have been thinking.
I'm not sure I can imagine.
Yeah, I don't either. I can't imagine what they were thinking. But I do know that it was an interesting experience, because all of a sudden they're exposed to all of this. And one of the things that we tried to do was to help them better understand the kinds of foods that when they went to the grocery store that they should be looking for amongst all these choices, so that, you know, they would be eating properly and not spending money that they didn't need to spend on various products. So, you know, we tried to help them with that. Tried to explain, for example, the meats that were there. One of the things we learned quite quickly was that chicken was a mainstay of their diet. And so you would frequently, well, made of chicken and rice. Those were, that was pretty much the mainstay. But I remember one of the things that we tried to do, because they had a couple of children and they needed to stretch the money that they had, was we thought orange juice would be a good thing for them. But we thought orange juice, as we, you know, buying it would be a little bit expensive. So the first thing that we did was suggest that they buy some Tang, which was the orange juice concentrate that the astronauts had been using.
Alan was just talking about Tang. He's got a...
And, but we found, humorously, we found a little bit later that probably wasn't the smartest thing we ever did, because whenever we would go over, it was kind of almost like some exposure to the European cultures that they were, you know, the French especially, that they were exposed to previously. And, you know, they'd come out with a little tray of these little cups, you know, and instead of tea, they'd bring Tang. And it wasn't cold, it was lukewarm Tang. And so that was...
Came back to haunt you.
It came back to haunt us. The other thing that was interesting is that, you know, after a little while, they got accustomed to cooking things on the stove and what have you, but they hadn't learned that in America we generally serve our food warm or hot, and it was rare that we would ever go over there if there was a meal to be served that we didn't have cold chicken and cold rice. Not cold, but lukewarm. It would be sitting there, you know, and it wouldn't be served, which was kind of interesting. And I don't know if that was a cultural thing or if it was just because they hadn't gotten acclimated to preparing foods at a time when you and then eating them in a time frame that was, you know, I,
they
and I
probably
don't
weren't
know
used
what,
to refrigeration.
Right, they weren't used to refrigeration. They weren't used to, you know, the fact that they could warm these things up. And we hadn't gotten to that point, I don't think, in trying to help them to understand. One of the things that, as far as what we did as a committee, was finding a job for.
So what was that like?
And I didn't do that. Betty did. There was a gentleman who owned a local car dealership at the time. Gave Tong a job, the car wash rack, basically washing the new cars, as you know, and preparing them as, you know, for delivery. I know that Tong was an extremely hard worker. But as I look back now, I can imagine the fact that that was in a period where jobs were pretty easy to come by, compared to what an immigrant to this country might face today if they weren't highly educated. We have a tendency now, we only want to select those that are highly educated to be immigrants, and, unless you're... You run out of your country for political reasons, we won't accept you if you don't have.
Now, how do you think that was for him? Since he had, I mean, and I've heard this time and again, but, you know, he was working for the military, and now suddenly he's washing cars or drying cars. How do you think that was for him, that sort of whole switch, and even though he obviously had to have work to feed his family?
I think because he had been exposed to the American military and probably, you know, exposed to some American thoughts as a result,
mm-hmm.
that it was easier for him to make the transition. I remember him as being a very intelligent individual, very easy. He grasped things in this transition very quickly. And I think that was a major advantage for him and his family. But that was probably because of his exposure to things American, even though he was in, you know, he'd never been here to experience them directly. They had ended up having a number of children. I remember the discussion that they came here supported by Catholic Church, and apparently they were Catholic, I know that there was a desire at the time to teach them the rhythm method. I'm not sure that ever worked because the method didn't work or whatever, but we did have a couple that came over and talked to them about that, but I think a lot was lost in the translation because May Lu could not grasp.
From whatever I've read, and I don't know a lot, but that because there had been such a tremendous loss of family members through the war, when they became refugees, whether they had actually been, I think they lost like at least half the male population, which included boys as well as men. During the war, and then trying to cross the Mekong, lots of people died,
right.
A lot of them drowned. So from what I understand, they were into having large families.
Yeah, I would think so. And so I don't know, you know, there was at some point, you know, probably a desire on their part to repopulate and certainly understand that. Based on their experiences, I'm sure quite a few people died in the camps as well.
Oh yeah.
Just for lack of you know, kind of medical attention that they had.
And proper nutrition.
And proper nutrition.
Do you remember any other experiences you had with them? You know, now that I'm asking you to kind of go back to that period, I know it's hard because we're talking almost 40 years ago.
Yeah, those were the main ones that I can recall. unfortunately, Betty Marsh would have been an excellent person to speak with, because she had even more intimate experiences, but then she passed away about a year ago, so.
You know, I've noticed that's happened with a number of people, that their sponsors.
Well, I think it's because of the age, obviously, the time period. You're looking at the mid-70s, and most of us were, I mean, we were, you know, in our mid-20s at the time, and Betty, I think, was, she had almost a grown family, so she had to be in her late 40s, you know, early 50s, and so, you know, which was, you know, typical of the people that were involved. And, you know, so obviously 40 years later, you are losing a fair number of the folks. And for those of us that you're not losing, our memories are not quite what they used to be.
Well, but it also tells us of, I mean, not a tremendous generalization, but who the people were primarily who were helping these people. They were 40s or 50s. Whether or not they had more time, whether they had more, maybe time.
Yeah, I think it depends. It was, I know in my own case, I was probably more active in doing more things in my 20s than I ever was, because after that, my three different careers were quite time consuming, so in that period in time, I you know, we only had one child at that point, and I was active in a lot of things because of my activity in the political process, and I was a board member of the JCs in Grand Ledge. I started the Knights of Columbus in Grand Ledge. And I served on the city council in Grand Ledge. I was doing all these things in my mid-20s, mid to late 20s. By the time then I got into my 30s, and all of a sudden I had a job that was almost all-consuming, where I was doing an awful lot of traveling. And then we had a second child, and then, you know, and a third. So I didn't have the same opportunity to be as active in things as I had previously been.
Now, I'm not sure if you told me or not, that you've heard maybe that these people moved out of town, which is a common phenomenon, that people
It was my understanding that they ultimately moved to California. There's no way I can determine whether or not that was actually true. Other than my recollection of something that Betty had said to me, and I can't, since she's no longer alive, I don't know for sure. But it was my understanding that they had moved to California and that he had become relatively successful. Yes, where have you been?
No, we didn't.